Hi, I'm Kumi Taguchi and I host a TV show in Australia called Insight, which is unlike any other.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Every week in the same room, we have dozens of guests telling their stories about one shared issue.
There definitely was three people in my marriage.
I started an affair with this man.
From sex and relationships to health, wealth and grief.
Dad, there's been a shooting at the elementary school.
And there's always a guest whose story stays with me.
I actually had guilt for not killing someone.
And I'm left feeling there's so much more I want to ask them. I often wonder, where are they now? So that's what I do here. I go back and I dig a little deeper. This is Insightful. In this episode, I catch up with Darren Wagner. I first met Darren on an Insight episode about guilt and how it shapes us. Darren was sharing his experience of a specific kind of guilt, survivor guilt. He felt a lot of it in the wake of the Sandy Hook school shooting in the United States.
The worst grade school shooting in U.S. history, at least 27 dead, 20 children, 7 adults, including the principal.
Many of the shooter's victims, the youngest children in the school.
Darren and his Australian wife moved to Sandy Hook because they thought it would be a safe community for their family. Their sons survived the shooting, but 20 children and 6 teachers did not.
How did you feel about your kids surviving and some of your friends' children not surviving?
It wasn't until a friend of mine who he lost his son asked how my sons were doing. And I went, oh, I wasn't expecting that kind of a question. And that was just intense, intense guilt.
The survivor guilt Darren carried after Sandy Hook came on top of a PTSD diagnosis that went back to his days as a cop. And yet he still managed to support his grief-stricken community in the weeks and months after the shooting. I know in my own life, when I've got some things on my mind, I go for a run. And that's something I learned Darren does too. So to kick things off, we hit the pavement.
So we're actually running and chatting at the same time. Let's see how long this lasts.
Let's see how we can manage.
And it's a muggy, hot Sydney day. How did you feel after that first run? Do you remember the first run?
Amazing.
Yeah.
I could sleep.
Wow.
I wasn't agitated. So I knew that there was an instant benefit, and it was something that I could control.
Darren, it's so great to see you again.
Thanks, Kumi. It's great to be here.
As we record this interview, Darren, I'm conscious that it's almost 11 years to the day since the Sandy Hook shooting in the US. At the time, you were living in Newtown, Connecticut with your wife and your two sons. Why did you decide to move from Australia and settle there?
I often ask myself that. My wife had suggested maybe we move back and reconnect with family that we had back in the States, and thought, you know, great idea to give them an American experience. Unfortunately, looking back, they got probably one of the more common, sadly, American experiences, a shooting in a school.
When an anniversary like this comes around, how does it feel when you sort of wake up and look at that date?
Anniversaries for those that have experienced something, those numbers, 9/11 is a good example. For us, it was the number 26. I think for myself and for my family, with recovery, you can see those numbers and not actually kind of be activated around the event.
So you can just see it and it sort of passes you by in a way. The media makes a lot of anniversaries.
And it's great to reflect. I think it's really important, especially events that shouldn't have happened. There's natural disasters that we can't change sometimes. But I think when we have these man-made disasters, that I think it really is important to reflect and go, have we changed laws? Have we changed a society to address some of the underlying issues that actually kind of spawned it?
I've always been interested in those moments, those singular moments that change the direction of our lives. For Darren, that was on a December morning in 2012.
How did you learn, Darren, that there was an active shooter at Sandy Hook?
So I was actually had gotten up early and was doing some Photoshop work, and I saw a little email pop up from a little alert from Outlook that just said a school shooting, and it kind of caught my eye and it faded. And I thought, well, that's not something I see often, so I'm going to go ahead and open it up. The Newtown Township had sent out an email to all parents that had been a shooting at a school. And even at that time, we didn't know which one. Looked at it and I went,
You have two sons?
Yes.
They weren't injured in the shooting. Where were they that day?
So luckily, our youngest had decided to stay home sick. So you go, fate.
He would have been in the elementary school?
Well, he would have been at the middle school. So there was a cluster of schools right around that. We knew that our youngest was home. So right away, where's our oldest? Where is he? And he was at the high school, which is just a few minutes from the elementary school. Learning that there was a school shooting, but not knowing which school it was, for the first 10, 15 minutes, time basically stopped for me.
One of the moments I remember most from the time you were at Insight was when you were telling us about how your eldest son was basically giving you updates from his school.
Very quickly, when we knew that it was really an active shooting situation, reaching out to him and going, are you okay? And he goes, yes. He goes, Dad, are you aware of what's happening? Yes. Before the news had even, before CNN had scrolled it on the ticker tape as an update, he was giving us live. He said, the principal's dead. So
you've got CNN on in the background.
Yeah.
You're looking at the
looking
ticker.
Looking for news.
And then your son's telling you stuff that you're finding out before anyone else is.
Yeah.
When you were getting those texts, I can't even imagine what you would be feeling at that time.
And I think that's a great comment, because when we look back at an event, is there something that we should have done? And one of the parents who did lose a child in it had heard that one too many times, and in my presence, and she told somebody, she said, you can imagine what it's like. Mm. We choose not to. We don't want to imagine that that's a text or an event that we would get in. So it's quite easy for us to distance ourselves by going, well, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I think for those of us that when it's, especially gun violence in America, we need to imagine. We really need to get close to that event, because that's where the change happens.
That's a really good point, because I can say, well, I can't imagine what it would be like. But actually, if I think about it, if that was my daughter sending me texts, giving me live updates, I mean, I'd feel sick. I would feel like I'd want to run there and try and get her.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to call my family and say, this is happening. But I can imagine also I'd just be in kind of information gathering mode.
And that was it. The TV was on. We're checking the phones. We're getting live texts. We're texting our friends and other families that we knew. What were they doing? Where were they at? Once we knew which school it actually was, and I think that comes down to that guilt of going, okay, it wasn't the high school.
Whew. So you're feeling relief?
Well, feeling relief. And then, as the news often does in these school shootings, there's a report of a second shooter. So just about the time that there's that relief and you're going, he's safe, the news is saying there's a probability there's a second shooter. And my son, I didn't realize until months later, because he became an activist in his own right, is that he said that they had barricaded themselves in their classroom, put the chairs up against the thing, and he was prepared to grab a chair when the door opened and throw it. That's all he had, but he was prepared to be the first one to grab it. So he was already planning. I remember him saying it's something that, no kid should ever have to think about, is, facing an armed person in a classroom.
How old was he at the time?
About 14.
Gosh. When he got home that day, I mean, how did he get home? Did he get the school bus home?
Being a former policeman, I wanted to, literally run there, intervene, but they'd already shut everything down by that point. There was a helicopter, we could hear the helicopter over our house because we lived just within a few minutes of the school. So there was news helicopters, police helicopters, sirens. My family needed me there because they had, pretty much gone into shock at that space. So I needed to be a first responder at home.
And when he walked through the door, what was that like?
So the bus pulled up. We both ran over and grabbed him and just hugged, just held him. I think we stood in the driveway. I don't know how long. It would have been a while. We just didn't let him go. We just all cried and then went back upstairs and crawled into Mom and Dad's bed, and all of us. just sat there, and I think we spent the first day in bed.
Just kind of processing.
Yeah. Time's a very different thing when you're in that space. There is a sense of disbelief. This isn't happening. This doesn't happen to us. And we were the lucky ones.
When did you realize that you were feeling guilty about the fact that your sons survived?
A really great friend of mine, Neil Heslin, who lost his son. Neil asked, he says, how are the boys doing? And I didn't know how to answer. It was really hard, and I didn't have an answer. I tried to pretend I didn't hear it. He had lost his son, and it took me quite a while to be very humble and realize that he really wanted to know. I had to accept that. We still keep in touch and give him updates of where they're at.
Did you ever say to him, I feel guilty about telling you about my sons because you've lost your...
I'll probably send him a link to this.
Yeah.
I think it's an important conversation that we have because we don't talk about the guilt. I've had to learn to be humble over the years and answer it, but having that discussion of going, I don't know how to respond to that, honestly, and it's hard.
I guess if the situation, touch wood and terribly, were reversed, I can imagine you would want to know how his sons or children were doing.
What a beautiful way of looking at it, because I honestly would. We want to know. Just because I have a loss doesn't mean that I don't care about my friends and family. Hopefully we don't become that jaded, that we lose love and compassion for others.
Darren is tall and has a gentle strength that immediately makes you feel comfortable. You can tell he's the kind of person who would be able to have a chat with anyone at any time, no matter what they were going through. In the aftermath of the shooting, you then became an advocate for gun legislation. How did that start to unfold?
Accidentally, because my wife, she was perusing the papers and saw that there was going to be a protest at the Walmart, which was about 20 minutes down the road from us. And they had gathered, I think, 100,000 signatures or something. And then a woman who had lost her daughter in another shooting. The gun violence survivors community is a very small, well, growing, unfortunately. So it's a club that nobody wants to belong to, but the membership is growing. So she said, look, I think we should go and do something positive and at least try to get the guns out of our community. And I went, yeah, sure. And much like I'm doing here today is that accidentally somebody had come up and said, oh, you're actually from Sandy Hook. And because we were really the first family to come out because everyone was still grieving. So we just kind of stepped up and somebody had put a mic in front of my face and said, well, what do you think? It started from that, going, look, we need to do something. It's not okay to have these, weapons of mass destruction. We need to do better. I wanted to speak because I needed to do something productive. But I think it was through these events that I started meeting people who had really lost directly. And I was so impacted because whenever I met a survivor of gun violence, I could see they would always wear a little photo button of their child. And I started noticing bigger and bigger crowds. And I was very, very lucky to speak in New York, in Harlem. I was invited to speak and they said, would you come down? And I said, absolutely, would love to. So I get down there. There was 20,000 people. I was going to go on right after Tony Bennett. And I had left my script behind me. So it was, again, these surreal moments that, he was there. Tony was a big advocate for gun violence and the Gun Violence Act of New York City. And he came over and gave me a big hug. And he goes, I got them all warmed up for you, Darren. And I went, oh, my gosh. What has become of my life? And I stepped out on that stage as probably one of the biggest frauds. Because I'm looking down and my wife and son was down there. And I'm like, I just met some survivors, mothers who had lost children in Harlem. And the news never covered theirs. They said, look, ours, other than the obituary, there was nothing, no cards, no teddy bears, no candles. So I realized right then I was quite in a unique position to have a spotlight. But when people asked me, what did I think? And I would point over to the mothers in Harlem that, had lost, their sons and daughters. I said, here's the people. These are the experts. It shifted from being me talking to then being with other people in that space. And I think that's really where I found my calling.
Americans have the constitutional right to bear arms, and the 20-year-old Sandy Hook shooter had a few, including rifles and semi-automatic weapons. His mother bought them legally and had a permit to use them. As Sandy Hook reignited debate about gun violence in the US, the president at the time, Barack Obama, paid a visit to the small town.
he did come to our community, and a friend of mine who is the rabbi contacted me about 2 days later, and he said, I got a really interesting phone call from the White House. And I said, from who and why? And he said, oh, it was President Obama wanted to come and pray with us. I'll never forget, you know, our oldest son had been fairly non-emotional about it, a bit distant, and we decided to go and listen to him speak and to be part of that, because it was in the high school gym, so this was his school. So to see the president eventually get up and gave an amazing address to us, and my son actually started to cry for the first time in that moment, and he said, Dad, he's just a father.
Mm.
And I said, yeah, that's how it struck him.
Was the activism a way for you to sort of process the trauma and the grief of the shooting?
Look, I think for me it was more, I couldn't allow my kids to get back on a school bus knowing that we hadn't changed anything. How do we let our kids get back on a bus and nothing has changed in our communities? And then meeting other victims in the gun violence survivor communities from, you know, the Aurora movie shooting, and got to meet with Michael Moore with the Bowling for Columbine. There was such a momentum, and it was a way of trying to change to make it safer so we could live there. And then when I realized that I was starting to receive death threats, and my wife was quite worried, she said, you know that they really do want to shoot you. And so I said, what do you want me to do? And we asked the children, and they said, we'd like to move back to Australia. We had done this for 2 years, and we had watched sensible gun legislation get shot down time and time again, so that when we realized that we weren't going to change something, we decided to go, well, what do we have as a family? And luckily, my wife being Australian, my son's born here in Sydney, it was time to come back.
For Australians, we look at the US and we often think, why can't there be some shift and change on gun control? Are you ever asked those questions? We made changes really quickly here.
We took that to the Senate, to the House of Representatives. It was often thrown up in our face. We're not Australia. There's too much money, and it's become a culture and a sense of masculinity, and sometimes just safety. So every time these mass shootings happen, gun stocks go up because people run out because they're afraid. You know, they want to protect their families. And I think one of the most horrific things that had come out of it that I had heard was that, you know, there's a lot of proposals, and some schools actually have shifted to having their teachers actually armed. There was a lot of pushback saying, you know, it happened because the teachers were unarmed. I think, look, at that point, we decided that, you know, arming teachers, you know, Australia looked, you know, really good.
I knew Darren had attempted suicide many years before the Sandy Hook shooting. He'd been working in the front line of law enforcement as a policeman, and he'd been diagnosed with PTSD, and he was told to leave the police force. At the time, he was struggling to feed his young family and felt great shame that he couldn't work anymore.
I was actually going to food pantries, food banks, and we were probably going to lose the house if this had continued much longer. So I had two younger sons from a previous marriage, and I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to provide for them. So I thought, well, the only way out was a life insurance policy that I knew that existed. And I went and got it out. And in that space, it said that as long as you don't take your life in the first year of the contract, you're good. So I'm like, whew. I've got through the first year. I can now do this. They can get a payout. You know, the house will be paid off. College, you know, food. It made sense. So, you know, one day I had made, you know, the plans to end my life. It was only by an accident that a friend of mine had drove in, noticed, you know, the garage door ajar, and poked his head in. It was 1 minute. You know, it was truly 1 minute, because I had the lethal means and knew how to do it effectively. Then I was quite angry, because then I had to live. Here's something else that you weren't very good at. And then being admitted into a mental health system that didn't understand trauma and safety. And I think that was my first realization, is going, being hospitalized, and then being told that, you know, the next morning I had to come out because I was forcibly locked up. Locked up with people that I'd put in that facility, going, and it was hard for me because I said, those people are crazy. I said, I know, because I put them in there. Now I'm in here. So the next morning they came and woke me up and said, you need to come out for a group. And I went, group? And they said, yeah, we're going to do an art group. I said, I attempted to take my life yesterday, and you want me to come out and I'll never forget it. It was an art group where we had a little paper plate, some elbow macaroni, and a little bottle of white Elmer's glue. And I think it was at that point that I realized I didn't know much about mental health, but I thought, these people know even less than I do, that this is their way of addressing my hopelessness. And it's quite ironic now, because now I'm a big advocate of art therapy in time, when the person is ready, absolutely. And at some point, I hope to actually finish that macaroni art and hang it up.
It does seem a little... you know,
the day after,
a little bit early.
A little too soon.
What's it like, you know, I was conscious, should I, you know, get you to talk about that suicide attempt? Because we have this dance that we do have to do, like you don't want people to re-traumatise themselves. We don't want to talk about suicide too much publicly because there's this fear of copycat incidents. What are your views on that?
Look, it took me a long time for me to realize what I had, what I was attempting, and then honor the reason behind it. So that, you know, trying to get rid of that shame of going, look, at that point, my brain wasn't fully online. Lots of stuff going on in there. It's so important that we talk about it. And this is why I have come out and, you know, very openly as a, you know, suicide attempt survivor. If we were all to be very honest, we're all within 1 or 2 degrees. You know, we lose, you know, 3,000 people a year here in Australia. You know, 9 people today will choose, you know, to end their life. Coming back to Australia, that's why I found purpose. And that's another part of my recovery, is finding meaningful purpose of going, well, yes, I can talk about it because I've spent a lot of time looking at my story, reflecting on it, and getting some good support. So it's really important that we do talk about it.
Your sons are now in their 20s. How are they going?
Amazing. I am very, very proud of them. They've flourished. So, you know, coming back to a country that has, you know, sensible gun legislation. So we don't worry about safety that way. We still have struggles like everyone else, and that's great. You know, it's great to see them finding their way, finding their new purpose. You know, I just couldn't be prouder of them. They've been through something that most kids will never imagine, but yeah, just couldn't be prouder of them.
Darren, it is such a pleasure to see you again. Thank you so much for your time, for dropping in and being so honest. Have a beautiful day.
Thanks so much.
We ran out of time, but I wanted to tell you about the carved wooden artwork Darren carries around with him. It's about the size of a loaf of bread, and it says hope. I asked him about it as we said goodbye, and he told me that when he sits with someone who's at their lowest, someone who's lost all hope, he holds the sign in his hands, and he says to them, "I know you're not feeling any hope right now, and that's totally understandable. So until you do, I will hold hope for you, and one day I'll pass it back on." You've been listening to Insightful, an 8-part series from SBS, recorded in Sydney, Australia, on the land of the Gadigal people. Insightful is produced by Felicity Davey, Cassandra Allen and Kate Harassi, and edited by Maddox Foster. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay tuned for more. Until next time, I'm Kumi Taguchi. Thanks so much for your company.